For the New Intellectual by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 5. Man has been called a rational being, but rationality is a matter of choice, and the alternative his nature offers him is rational being or suicidal animal. Man has to be man by choice. He has to hold his life as a value by choice. He has to learn to sustain it by choice. He has to discover the values it requires and practice his virtues by choice. A code of values accepted by choice is a code of morality. Whoever you are, you who are hearing me now, I am speaking to whatever living remnant is left uncorrupted within you, to the remnant of the human, to your mind, and I say, there is a morality of reason. A morality proper to man, and man's life is its standard of value. All that which is proper to the life of a rational being is the good, all that which destroys it is the evil. Man's life, as required by his nature, is not the life of a mindless brute, of a looting thug, or a mooching mystic, but the life of a thinking being, not life by means of force or fraud, but life by means of achievement. Not survival at any price, since there's only one price that pays for man's survival. Reason. Man's life is the standard of morality, but your own life is its purpose. If existence on earth is your goal, you must choose your actions and values by the standard of that which is proper to man, for the purpose of preserving, fulfilling, and enjoying the irreplaceable value which is your life. Since life requires a specific course of action, any other course will destroy it. A being who does not hold his own life as the motive and goal of his actions is acting on the motive and standard of death. Such a being is a metaphysical monstrosity, struggling to oppose, negate, and contradict the fact of his own existence, running blindly amok on a trail of destruction, capable of nothing but pain. Happiness is the successful state of life. Pain is an agent of death. Happiness is that state of consciousness which proceeds from the achievement of one's values. A morality that dares to tell you to find happiness in the renunciation of your happiness, to value the failure of your values, is an insolent negation of morality. A doctrine that gives you, as an ideal, the role of a sacrificial animal seeking slaughter on the altars of others is giving you death as your standard. By the grace of reality and the nature of life, man, every man, is an end in himself. He exists for his own sake, and the achievement of his own happiness is his highest moral purpose. But neither life nor happiness can be achieved by the pursuit of irrational whims. Just as man is free to attempt to survive in any random manner, but will perish unless he lives as his nature requires, so he is free to seek his happiness in any mindless fraud. But the torture of frustration is all he will find unless he seeks the happiness proper to man. The purpose of morality is to teach you not to suffer and die, but to enjoy yourself and live. Sweep aside those parasites of subsidized classrooms who live on the profits of the mind of others, and proclaim that man needs no morality, no values, no code of behavior. They who pose as scientists and claim that man is only an animal do not grant him inclusion in the law of existence they have granted to the lowest of insects. They recognize that every living species has a way of survival demanded by its nature. They do not claim that a fish can live out of water or that a dog can live without its sense of smell, but man, they claim, the most complex of beings, man can survive in any way whatever. Man has no identity, no nature, and there's no practical reason why he cannot live with his means of survival destroyed, with his mind throttled and placed at the disposal of any orders they might care to issue. Sweep aside those hatred-eaten mystics who pose as friends of humanity and preach that the highest virtue man can practice is to hold his own life as of no value. Do they tell you that the purpose of morality is to curb man's instinct of self-preservation? It is for the purpose of self-preservation that man needs a code of morality. The only man who desires to be moral is the man who desires to live. No, you do not have to live. It is your basic act of choice. But if you choose to live, you must live as a man, by the work and the judgment of your mind. No, you do not have to live as a man. It is an act of moral choice. But you cannot live as anything else, and the alternative is that state of living death which you now see within you and around you, the state of a thing unfit for existence, no longer human and less than animal, a thing that knows nothing but pain and drags itself through its span of years in the agony of unthinking self-destruction. No, you do not have to think. It is an act of moral choice. But someone had to think to keep you alive. If you choose to default, you default on existence and you pass the deficit to some moral man, expecting him to sacrifice his good for the sake of letting you survive by your evil. No, you do not have to be a man. But today those who are not there any longer. I have removed your means of survival, your victims. If you wish to know how I have done it and what I told them to make them quit, you are hearing it now. I told them, in essence, the statement I am making tonight. They were men who had lived by my code but had not known how great a virtue it represented. I made them see it. I brought them not a re-evaluation, but only an identification of their values. We, the men of the mind, are now on strike against you, in the name of a single axiom, which is the root of our moral code, just as the root of yours is the wish to escape it. The axiom that existence exists. Existence exists, and the act of grasping that statement implies two corollary axioms. That something exists which one perceives, and that one exists possessing consciousness. Consciousness being the faculty of perceiving that which exists. If nothing exists, there can be no consciousness. A consciousness with nothing to be conscious of is a contradiction in terms. A consciousness conscious of nothing but itself is a contradiction in terms. Before it could identify itself as consciousness, it had to be conscious of something. If that which you claim to perceive does not exist, what you possess is not consciousness. Whatever the degree of your knowledge, these two, existence and consciousness, are axioms you cannot escape. These two are the irreducible primaries implied in any action you undertake, in any part of your knowledge and in its sum, from the first ray of light you perceive at the start of your day to the widest erudition you might acquire at its end. Whether you know the shape of a pebble or the structure of a solar system, the axioms remain the same, that it exists and that you know it. To exist is to be something as distinguished from the nothing of non-existence. It is to be an entity of a specific nature made of specific attributes. Centuries ago, the man who was, no matter what his errors, the greatest of your philosophers, has stated the formula defining the concept of existence and the rule of all knowledge. A is a thing is itself. You have never grasped the meaning of his statement. I am here to complete it. Existence is identity. Consciousness is identification. Whatever you choose to consider, be it an object, an attribute, or an action, the law of identity remains the same. A leaf cannot be a stone at the same time. It cannot be all red and all green at the same time. It cannot freeze and burn at the same time. A is A. Or if you wish it stated in simpler language, you cannot have your cake and eat it too. Are you seeking to know what is wrong with the world? All the disasters that have wrecked your world came from your leader's attempt to evade the fact that A is A. All the secret evil you dread to face within you, and all the pain you have ever endured, came from your own attempt to evade the fact that A is A. The purpose of those who taught you to evade it was to make you forget that man is man. Man cannot survive except by gaining knowledge, and reason is his only means to gain it. Reason is the faculty that perceives, identifies, and integrates the material provided by his senses. The task of his senses is to give him the evidence of existence, but the task of identifying it belongs to his reason. His senses tell him only that something is, but what it is must be learned by his mind. All thinking is a process of identification and integration. Man perceives a blob of color. By integrating the evidence of his sight and his touch, he learns to identify it as a solid object. He learns to identify the object as a table. He learns that the table is made of wood. He learns that wood consists of cells, that the cells consist of molecules, that the molecules consist of atoms. All through this process, the work of his mind consists of answers to a single question, what is it? His means to establish the truth of his answers is logic, and logic rests on the axiom that existence exists. Logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. A contradiction cannot exist. An atom is itself, and so is the universe. Neither can contradict its own identity. Nor can a part contradict the whole. No concept man forms is valid unless he integrates it without contradiction into the total sum of his knowledge. To arrive at a contradiction is to confess an error in one's thinking. To maintain a contradiction is to abdicate one's mind and to evict oneself from the realm of reality. Reality is that which exists. The unreal does not exist. The unreal is merely that negation of existence which is the content of a human consciousness when it attempts to abandon reason. Truth is the recognition of reality. Reason, man's only means of knowledge, is his only standard of truth. The most depraved sentence you can now utter is to ask, whose reason? The answer is yours. No matter how vast your knowledge or how modest, it is your own mind that has to acquire it. It is only with your own knowledge that you can deal. It is only your own knowledge that you can claim to possess or ask others to consider. Your mind is your only judge of truth, and if others dissent from your verdict, reality is the court of final appeal. Nothing but a man's mind can perform that complex, delicate, crucial process of identification, which is thinking. Nothing can direct the process but his own judgment. Nothing can direct his judgment but his moral integrity. You who speak of a moral instinct as if it were some separate endowment opposed to reason, man's reason is his moral faculty. A process of reason is a process of constant choice in answer to the question true or false, right or wrong. Is a seed to be planted in soil in order to grow, right or wrong? Is a man's wound to be disinfected in order to save his life, right or wrong? Does the nature of atmospheric electricity permit it to be converted into kinetic power, right or wrong? It is the answers to such questions that gave you everything you have. And the answers came from a man's mind, a mind of intransigent devotion to that which is right. A rational process is a moral process. You may make an error at any step of it, with nothing to protect you but your own severity. Or you may try to cheat, to fake the evidence and evade the effort of the quest. But if devotion to truth is the hallmark of morality, then there is no greater, nobler, more heroic form of devotion than the act of a man who assumes the responsibility of thinking. That which you call your soul or spirit is your consciousness. And that which you call free will is your mind's freedom to think or not. The only will you have, your only freedom, the choice that controls all the choices you make and determines your life and your character. Thinking is man's only basic virtue, from which all the others proceed. And his basic vice, the source of all his evils, is that nameless act which all of you practice, but struggle never to admit. The act of blanking out. The willful suspension of one's consciousness, the refusal to think, not blindness but the refusal to see, not ignorance but the refusal to know. It is the act of unfocusing your mind and inducing an inner fog to escape the responsibility of judgment on the unstated premise that a thing will not exist if only you refuse to identify it, that A will not be A so long as you do not pronounce the verdict, it is. Non-thinking is an act of annihilation, a wish to negate existence, an attempt to wipe out reality. But existence exists. Reality is not to be wiped out, it will merely wipe out the wiper. By refusing to say it is, you are refusing to say I am. By suspending your judgment, you are negating your person. When a man declares, who am I to know? He is declaring, who am I to live? This in every hour and every issue is your basic moral choice, thinking or non-thinking, existence or non-existence, A or non-A, entity or zero. To the extent to which a man is rational, life is the premise directing his actions. To the extent to which he is irrational, the premise directing his actions is death. You who prattle that morality is social, and that man would need no morality on a desert island, it is on a desert island that he would need it most. Let him try to claim, when there are no victims to pay for it, that a rock is a house, that sand is clothing, that food will drop into his mouth without cause or effort, that he will collect a harvest tomorrow by devouring his stock seed today, and reality will wipe him out as he deserves. Reality will show him that life is a value to be bought, and that thinking is the only coin noble enough to buy it. If I were to speak your kind of language, I would say that man's only moral commandment is, thou shalt think. But a moral commandment is a contradiction in terms. The moral is the chosen, not the forced. The understood, not the obeyed. The moral is the rational, and reason accepts no commandments. My morality, the morality of reason, is contained in a single axiom. Existence exists, and in a single choice, to live. The rest proceeds from these. To live, man must hold three things as the supreme and ruling values of his life: reason, purpose, self-esteem. Reason is his only tool of knowledge, purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve, self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means is worthy of living. These three values imply and require all of man's virtues, and all his virtues pertain to the relation of existence and consciousness. Rationality, independence, integrity, honesty, justice, productiveness, pride. Rationality is the recognition of the fact that existence exists, that nothing can alter the truth and nothing can take precedence over that act of perceiving it, which is thinking, that the mind is one's only judge of values and one's only guide of action, that reason is an absolute that permits no compromise, that a concession to the irrational invalidates one's consciousness and turns it from the task of perceiving to the task of faking reality, that the alleged shortcut to knowledge, which is faith, is only a short circuit destroying the mind, that the acceptance of a mystical invention is a wish for the annihilation of existence and properly annihilates one's consciousness. Independence is the recognition of the fact that yours is the responsibility of judgment, and nothing can help you escape it, that no substitute can do your thinking, as no pinch hitter can live your life, that the vilest form of self-abasement and self-destruction is the subordination of your mind to the mind of another, the acceptance of an authority over your brain, the acceptance of his assertions as facts, his sayings as truth, his edicts as middleman between your consciousness and your existence. Integrity is the recognition of the fact that you cannot fake your consciousness, just as honesty is the recognition of the fact that you cannot fake existence, that man is an indivisible entity, an integrated unit of two attributes, of matter and consciousness, and that he may permit no breach between body and mind, between action and thought, between his life and his convictions, that like a judge impervious to public opinion, he may not sacrifice his convictions to the wishes of others, be it the whole of mankind shouting pleas or threats against him, that courage and confidence are practical necessities, that courage is the practical form of being true to existence, of being true to truth, and confidence is the practical form of being true to one's own consciousness. Honesty is the recognition of the fact that the unreal is unreal and can have no value, that neither love nor fame nor cash is a value if obtained by fraud, that an attempt to gain a value by deceiving the mind of others is an act of raising your victims to a position higher than reality, where you become a pawn of their blindness, a slave of their non-thinking and their evasions, while their intelligence, their rationality, their perceptiveness become the enemies you have to dread and flee. That you do not care to live as a dependent, least of all a dependent on the stupidity of others, or as a fool whose source of values is the fools he succeeds in fooling. That honesty is not a social duty, not a sacrifice for the sake of others, but the most profoundly selfish virtue man can practice. His refusal to sacrifice the reality of his own existence to the deluded consciousness of others. Justice is the recognition of the fact that you cannot fake the character of men, as you cannot fake the character of nature, that you must judge all men as conscientiously as you judge inanimate objects, with the same respect for truth, with the same incorruptible vision, by as pure and as rational a process of identification, that every man must be judged for what he is and treated accordingly. That just as you do not pay a higher price for a rusty chunk of scrap than for a piece of shining metal, so you do not value a rotter above a hero. That your moral appraisal is the coin paying men for their virtues or vices, and this payment demands of you as scrupulous an honor as you bring to financial transactions. That to withhold your contempt from men's vices is an act of moral counterfeiting, and to withhold your admiration from their virtues is an act of moral embezzlement. That to place any other concern higher than justice is to devaluate your moral currency and defraud the good in favor of the evil, since only the good can lose by a default of justice and only the evil can profit. And that the bottom of the pit at the end of that road, the act of moral bankruptcy, is to punish men for their virtues and reward them for their vices. That is the collapse of full depravity, the black mass of the worship of death, the dedication of your consciousness to the destruction of existence. Productiveness is your acceptance of morality, your recognition of the fact that you choose to live, that productive work is the process by which man's consciousness controls his existence, a constant process of acquiring knowledge and shaping matter to fit one's purpose, of translating an idea into physical form, of remaking the earth in the image of one's values, that all work is creative work if done by a thinking mind, and no work is creative if done by a blank who repeats in uncritical stupor a routine he has learned from others, that your work is yours to choose, and the choice is as wide as your mind, that nothing more is possible to you and nothing less is human, that to cheat your way into a job bigger than your mind can handle is to become a fear-corroded ape on borrowed motions and borrowed time, and to settle down into a job that requires less than your mind's full capacity is to cut your motor and sentence yourself to another kind of motion, decay, that your work is the process of achieving your values, and to lose your ambition for values is to lose your ambition to live. That your body is a machine, but your mind is its driver, and you must drive as far as your mind will take you, with achievement as the goal of your road. That the man who has no purpose is a machine that coasts downhill at the mercy of any boulder to crash in the first chance ditch. That the man who stifles his mind is a stalled machine slowly going to rust. That the man who lets a leader prescribe his course is a wreck being towed to the scrap heap, and the man who makes another man his goal is a hitchhiker no driver should ever pick up. That your work is the purpose of your life, and you must speed past any killer who assumes the right to stop you. That any value you might find outside your work, any other loyalty or love, can be only travelers you choose to share your journey, and must be travelers going on their own power in the same direction. Pride is the recognition of the fact that you are your own highest value, and, like all of man's values, it has to be earned. That of any achievements open to you, the one that makes all others possible is the creation of your own character. That your character, your actions, your desires, your emotions are the products of the premises held by your mind. That as man must produce the physical values he needs to sustain his life, So he must acquire the values of character that make his life worth sustaining. That as man is a being of self-made wealth, so he is a being of self-made soul. That to live requires a sense of self-value, but man, who has no automatic values, has no automatic sense of self-esteem, and must earn it by shaping his soul in the image of his moral ideal, in the image of man, the rational being he is born able to create, but must create by choice. That the first precondition of self-esteem is that radiant selfishness of soul which desires the best in all things, in values of matter and spirit, a soul that seeks above all else to achieve its own moral perfection, valuing nothing higher than itself. And that the proof of an achieved self-esteem is your soul's shudder of contempt and rebellion against the role of a sacrificial animal, against the vile impertinence of any creed that proposes to immolate the irreplaceable value which is your consciousness and the incomparable glory which is your existence to the blind evasions and the stagnant decay of others. Are you beginning to see who is John Galt? I am the man who has earned the thing you did not fight for, the thing you have renounced, betrayed, corrupted, yet were unable fully to destroy, and are now hiding as your guilty secret, spending your life in apologies to every professional cannibal, lest it be discovered that somewhere within you you still long to say what I am now saying to the hearing of the whole of mankind. I am proud of my own value and of the fact that I wish to live. This wish, which you share yet submerge as an evil, is the only remnant of the good within you. But it is a wish one must learn to deserve. His own happiness is man's only moral purpose, but only his own virtue can achieve it. Virtue is not an end in itself. Virtue is not its own reward or sacrificial fodder for the reward of evil. Life is the reward of virtue, and happiness is the goal and the reward of life. Just as your body has two fundamental sensations, pleasure and pain, as signs of its welfare or injury, as a barometer of its basic alternative, life or death, so your consciousness has two fundamental emotions, joy and suffering, in answer to the same alternative. Your emotions are estimates of that which furthers your life or threatens it, lightning calculators giving you a sum of your profit or loss. You have no choice about your capacity to feel that something is good for you or evil. But what you will consider good or evil, what will give you joy or pain, what you will love or hate, desire or fear, depends on your standard of value. Emotions are inherent in your nature, but their content is dictated by your mind. Your emotional capacity is an empty motor, and your values are the fuel with which your mind fills it. If you choose a mix of contradictions, it will clog your motor, corrode your transmission, and wreck you on your first attempt to move with a machine which you, the driver, have corrupted. If you hold the irrational as your standard of value and the impossible as your concept of the good, if you long for rewards you have not earned, for a fortune or a love you don't deserve, for a loophole in the law of causality, for an A that becomes non-A at your whim, if you desire the opposite of existence, you will reach it. Do not cry when you reach it that life is frustration and that happiness is impossible to man. Check your fuel. It brought you where you wanted to go. Happiness is not to be achieved at the command of emotional whims. Happiness is not the satisfaction of whatever irrational wishes you might blindly attempt to indulge. Happiness is a state of non-contradictory joy. A joy without penalty or guilt. A joy that does not clash with any of your values and does not work for your own destruction. Not the joy of escaping from your mind, but of using your mind's fullest power. Not the joy of faking reality, but achieving values that are real. Not the joy of a drunkard, but of a producer. Happiness is possible only to a rational man. The man who desires nothing but rational goals, seeks nothing but rational values, and finds his joy in nothing but rational actions. just as I support my life neither by robbery nor alms, but by my own effort, so I do not seek to derive my happiness from the injury or the favor of others, but earn it by my own achievement. Just as I do not consider the pleasure of others as the goal of my life, so I do not consider my pleasure as the goal of the lives of others. Just as there are no contradictions in my values, and no conflicts among my desires, so there are no victims and no conflicts of interest among rational men, men who do not desire the unearned, and who do not view one another with a cannibal's lust, men who neither make sacrifices nor accept them. The symbol of all relationships among such men, the moral symbol of respect for human beings, is the trader. We who live by values, not by loot, are traders, both in matter and in spirit. A trader is a man who earns what he gets and does not give or take the undeserved. A trader does not ask to be paid for his failures, nor does he ask to be loved for his flaws. A trader does not squander his body as fodder or his soul as alms. Just as he does not give his work except in trade for material values, so he does not give the values of his spirit, his love, his friendship, his esteem, except in payment and in trade for human virtues, in payment for his own selfish pleasure, which he receives from men he can respect. The mystic parasites, who have throughout the ages reviled the traders and held them in contempt, while honoring the beggars and the looters, have known the secret motive of their sneers. A trader is the entity they dread, a man of justice. Do you ask what moral obligation I owe to my fellow men? None, except the obligation I owe to myself, to material objects, and to all of existence. Rationality. I deal with men as my nature and theirs demands, by means of reason. I seek or desire nothing from them except such relations as they care to enter of their own voluntary choice. It is only with their mind that I can deal, and only for my own self-interest, when they see that my interest coincides with theirs. When they don't, I enter no relationship. I let dissenters go their way, and I do not swerve from mine. I win by means of nothing but logic, and I surrender to nothing but logic. I do not surrender my reason, or deal with men who surrender theirs. I have nothing to gain from fools or cowards. I have no benefits to seek from human vices, from stupidity, dishonesty, or fear. The only value men can offer me is the work of their mind. When I disagree with a rational man, I let reality be our final arbiter. If I am right, he will learn. If I am wrong, I will. One of us will win. But both will profit. Whatever may be open to disagreement, there is one act of evil that may not. The act that no man may commit against others, and no man may sanction or forgive. So long as men desire to live together, no man may initiate. Do you hear me? No man may start the use of physical force against others. To interpose the threat of physical destruction between a man and his perception of reality is to negate and paralyze his means of survival. To force him to act against his own judgment is like forcing him to act against his own sight. Whoever, to whatever purpose or extent, initiates the use of force is a killer acting on the premise of death in a manner wider than murder, the premise of destroying man's capacity to live. Do not open your mouth to tell me that your mind has convinced you of your right to force my mind. Force and mind are opposites. Morality ends where a gun begins. When you declare that men are irrational animals and propose to treat them as such, you define thereby your own character and can no longer claim the sanction of reason, as no advocate of contradictions can claim it. There can be no right to destroy the source of rights, the only means of judging right and wrong, the mind. To force a man to drop his own mind and to accept your will as a substitute, with a gun in place of a syllogism, with terror in place of proof, and death as the final argument, is to attempt to exist in defiance of reality. Reality demands of man that he act for his own rational interest. Your gun demands of him that he act against it. Reality threatens man with death if he does not act on his rational judgment. You threaten him with death if he does. You place him in the world where the price of his life is the surrender of all the virtues required by life. And death by a process of gradual destruction is all that you and your system will achieve when death is made to be the ruling power, the winning argument in a society of men. Be it a highwayman who confronts a traveler with the ultimatum, your money or your life, or a politician who confronts a country with the ultimatum, your children's education or your life. The meaning of that ultimatum is your mind or your life, and neither is possible to man without the other. If there are degrees of evil, it is hard to say who is the more contemptible. The brute who assumes the right to force the mind of others, or the moral degenerate who grants to others the right to force his mind. That is the moral absolute one does not leave open to debate. I do not grant the terms of reason to men who propose to deprive me of reason. I do not enter discussions with neighbors who think they can forbid me to think. I do not place my moral sanction upon a murderer's wish to kill me. When a man attempts to deal with me by force, I answer him. By force. It is only as retaliation that force may be used, and only against the man who starts its use. No, I do not share his evil, or sink to his concept of morality. I merely grant him his choice, destruction, the only destruction he had the right to choose, his own. He uses force to seize a value, I use it only to destroy destruction. A hold-up man seeks to gain wealth by killing me. I do not grow richer by killing a hold-up man. I seek no values by means of evil, nor do I surrender my values to evil. In the name of all the producers who had kept you alive and received your death ultimatums in payment, I now answer you with a single ultimatum of your own. Our work or your guns. You can choose either, you can't have both. We do not initiate the use of force against others or submit to force at their hands. If you desire ever again to live in an industrial society, it will be on our moral terms. Our terms and our motive power are the antithesis of yours. You have been using fear as your weapon and have been bringing death to man as his punishment for rejecting your morality. We offer him life as his reward for accepting ours. You who are worshippers of the zero, you have never discovered that achieving life is not the equivalent of avoiding death. Joy is not the absence of pain. Intelligence is not the absence of stupidity. Light is not the absence of darkness. An entity is not the absence of a non-entity. Building is not done by abstaining from demolition. Centuries of sitting and waiting in such abstinence will not raise one single girder for you to abstain from demolishing. And now you can no longer say to me, the builder, produce and feed us in exchange for our not destroying your production. I am answering in the name of all your victims. Perish with and in your own void. Existence is not a negation of negatives. Evil, not value, is an absence and a negation. Evil is impotent and has no power but that which we let it extort from us. Perish, because we have learned that a zero cannot hold a mortgage over life. You seek escape from pain, we seek the achievement of happiness. You exist for the sake of avoiding punishment. We exist for the sake of earning rewards. Threats will not make us function. Fear is not our incentive. It is not death that we wish to avoid, but life that we wish to live. You who have lost the concept of the difference, you who claim that fear and joy are incentives of equal power, and secretly add that fear is the more practical, you do not wish to live, and only fear of death still holds you to the existence you have damned. You dart in panic through the trap of your days, looking for the exit you have closed, running from a pursuer you dare not name, to a terror you dare not acknowledge, and the greater your terror, the greater your dread of the only act that could save you, thinking. The purpose of your struggle is not to know, not to grasp or name or hear the thing I shall now state to your hearing, that yours is the morality of death. Death is the standard of your values. Death is your chosen goal, and you have to keep running, since there is no escape from the pursuer who is out to destroy you, or from the knowledge that that pursuer is yourself. Stop running for once. There is no place to run. Stand naked, as you dread to stand, but as I see you, and take a look at what you dared to call a moral code. Damnation is the start of your morality. Destruction is its purpose, means, and end. Your code begins by damning man as evil, then demands that he practice a good which it defines as impossible for him to practice. It demands as his first proof of virtue that he accept his own depravity without proof. It demands that he start not with a standard of value, but with a standard of evil, which is himself, by means of which he is then to define the good. The good is that which he is not. It does not matter who then becomes the profiteer on his renounced glory and tormented soul, a mystic god with some incomprehensible design, or any passer-by whose rotting sores are held as some inexplicable claim upon him. It does not matter. The good is not for him to understand. His duty is to crawl through years of penance, atoning for the guilt of his existence to any stray collector of unintelligible debts. His only concept of a value is a zero. The good is that which is non-man. The name of this monstrous absurdity is original sin. A sin without volition is a slap at morality and an insolent contradiction in terms. That which is outside the possibility of choice is outside the province of morality. If man is evil by birth, he has no will, no power to change it. If he has no will, he can be neither good nor evil. A robot is amoral. To hold as man's sin a fact not open to his choice is a mockery of morality. To hold man's nature as his sin is a mockery of nature. To punish him for a crime he committed before he was born is a mockery of justice. To hold him guilty in a matter where no innocence exists is a mockery of reason. To destroy morality, nature, justice, and reason by means of a single concept is a feat of evil hardly to be matched, yet that is the root of your code. Do not hide behind the cowardly evasion that man is born with free will, but with a tendency to evil. A free will saddled with a tendency is like a game with loaded dice. It forces man to struggle through the effort of playing, to bear responsibility and pay for the game, but the decision is weighted in favor of a tendency that he had no power to escape. If the tendency is of his choice, he cannot possess it at birth. If it is not of his choice, his will is not free. What is the nature of the guilt that your teachers call his original sin? What are the evils man acquired when he fell from a state they consider perfection? Their myth declares that he ate the fruit of the tree of knowledge. He acquired a mind and became a rational being. It was the knowledge of good and evil. He became a moral being. He was sentenced to earn his bread by his labor. He became a productive being. He was sentenced to experience desire. He acquired the capacity of sexual enjoyment. The evils for which they damn him are reason, morality, creativeness, joy, all the cardinal values of his existence. It is not his vices that their myth of man's fall is designed to explain and condemn. It is not his errors that they hold as his guilt, but the essence of his nature as man. Whatever he was, that robot in the Garden of Eden who existed without mind, without values, without labor, without love, he was not man. Man's fall, according to your teachers, was that he gained the virtues required to live. These virtues, by their standard, are his sin. His evil, they charge, is that he's man. His guilt, they charge, is that he lives. They call it a morality of mercy and a doctrine of love for man. No, they say, they do not preach that man is evil. The evil is only that alien object, his body. No, they say, they do not wish to kill him, they only wish to make him lose his body. They seek to help him, they say, against his pain, and they point at the torture rack to which they've tied him. The rack with two wheels that pull him in opposite directions, the rack of the doctrine that splits his soul and body. They have cut man in two, setting one half against the other. They have taught him that his body and his consciousness are two enemies engaged in deadly conflict, two antagonists of opposite natures, contradictory claims, incompatible needs. that to benefit one is to injure the other, that his soul belongs to a supernatural realm, but his body is an evil prison, holding it in bondage to this earth, and that the good is to defeat his body, to undermine it by years of patient struggle, digging his way to that glorious jailbreak that leads into the freedom of the grave. They have taught man that he is a hopeless misfit made of two elements, both symbols of death. A body without a soul is a corpse. A soul without a body is a ghost. Yet such is their image of man's nature, the battleground of a struggle between a corpse and a ghost. A corpse endowed with some evil volition of its own, and a ghost endowed with the knowledge that everything known to man is non-existent, that only the unknowable exists. Do you observe what human faculty that doctrine was designed to ignore? It was man's mind that had to be negated in order to make him fall apart. Once he surrendered reason, he was left at the mercy of two monsters whom he could not fathom or control, of a body moved by unaccountable instincts, and a soul moved by mystic revelations. He was left as the passively ravaged victim of a battle between a robot and a dictaphone. And as he now crawls through the wreckage, groping blindly for a way to live, your teachers offer him the help of a morality that proclaims that he'll find no solution and must seek no fulfillment on earth. Real existence, they tell him, is that which he cannot perceive. True consciousness is the faculty of perceiving the non-existent, and if he is unable to understand it, that is the proof that his existence is evil and his consciousness impotent. As products of the split between man's soul and body, there are two kinds of teachers of the morality of death, the mystics of spirit and the mystics of muscle, whom you call the spiritualists and the materialists, those who believe in consciousness without existence, and those who believe in existence without consciousness. Both demand the surrender of your mind, one to their revelations, the other to their reflexes. No matter how loudly they posture in the roles of irreconcilable antagonists, their moral codes are alike, and so are their aims. In matter, the enslavement of man's body; in spirit, the destruction of his mind. The good, say the mystics of spirit, is God, a being whose only definition is that he is beyond man's power to conceive, a definition that invalidates man's consciousness and nullifies his concepts of existence. The good, say the mystics of muscle, is society, a thing which they define as an organism that possesses no physical form, a super being embodied in no one in particular, and everyone in general, except yourself. Man's mind, say the mystics of spirit, must be subordinated to the will of God. Man's mind, say the mystics of muscle, must be subordinated to the will of society. Man's standard of value, say the mystics of spirit, is the pleasure of God, whose standards are beyond man's power of comprehension and must be accepted on faith. Man's standard of value, say the mystics of muscle, is the pleasure of society, whose standards are beyond man's right of judgment and must be obeyed as a primary absolute. The purpose of man's life, say both, is to become an abject zombie who serves a purpose he does not know for reasons he is not to question. His reward, say the mystics of spirit, will be given to him beyond the grave. His reward, say the mystics of muscle, will be given on earth to his great-grandchildren. Selfishness, say both, is man's evil. Man's good, say both, is to give up his personal desires, to deny himself, renounce himself, surrender. Man's good is to negate the life he lives. Sacrifice, cry both, is the essence of morality, the highest virtue within man's reach. Whoever is now within reach of my voice, whoever is man the victim, not man the killer, I am speaking at the deathbed of your mind, at the brink of that darkness in which you're drowning, and if there still remains within you the power to struggle to hold on to those fading sparks which had been yourself, use it now. The word that has destroyed you is sacrifice. Use the last of your strength to understand its meaning. You are still alive. You have a chance. Sacrifice does not mean the rejection of the worthless, but of the precious. Sacrifice does not mean the rejection of the evil for the sake of the good, but of the good for the sake of the evil. Sacrifice is the surrender of that which you value in favor of that which you don't. If you exchange a penny for a dollar, it is not a sacrifice. If you exchange a dollar for a penny, it is. If you achieve the career you wanted after years of struggle, it is not a sacrifice. If you then renounce it for the sake of a rival, it is. If you own a bottle of milk and give it to your starving child, it is not a sacrifice. If you give it to your neighbor's child and let your own die, it is. If you give money to help a friend, it is not a sacrifice. If you give it to a worthless stranger, it is. If you give your friend a sum you can afford, it is not sacrifice. If you give him money at the cost of your own discomfort, it is only a partial virtue according to this sort of moral standard. If you give him money at the cost of disaster to yourself, that is the virtue of sacrifice in full. If you renounce all personal desires and dedicate your life to those you love, you do not achieve full virtue. You still retain a value of your own, which is your love. If you devote your life to random strangers, it is an act of greater virtue. If you devote your life to serving men you hate, that is the greatest of the virtues you can practice. A sacrifice is the surrender of a value. Full sacrifice is full surrender of all values. If you wish to achieve full virtue, you must seek no gratitude in return for your sacrifice. No praise, no love, no admiration, no self-esteem, not even the pride of being virtuous. The faintest trace of any gain dilutes your virtue. If you pursue a course of action that does not taint your life by any joy, that brings you no value in matter, no value in spirit, no gain, no profit, no reward, if you achieve this state of total zero, you have achieved the ideal of moral perfection. You are told that moral perfection is impossible to man, and by this standard it is. You cannot achieve it so long as you live, but the value of your life and of your person is gauged by how closely you succeed in approaching that ideal zero, which is death. If you start, however, as a passionless blank, as a vegetable seeking to be eaten, with no values to reject and no wishes to renounce, you will not win the crown of sacrifice. It is not a sacrifice to renounce the unwanted. It is not a sacrifice to give your life for others if death is your personal desire. To achieve the virtue of sacrifice, you must want to live. You must love it. You must burn with passion for this earth and for all the splendor it can give you. You must feel the twist of every knife as it slashes your desires away from your reach and drains your love out of your body. It is not mere death that the morality of sacrifice holds out to you as an ideal, but death by slow torture. Do not remind me that it pertains only to this life on earth. I am concerned with no other. Neither are you. If you wish to save the last of your dignity, do not call your best actions a sacrifice. That term brands you as immoral. If a mother buys food for her hungry child rather than a hat for herself, it is not a sacrifice. She values the child higher than the hat. But it is a sacrifice to the kind of mother whose higher value is the hat, who would prefer her child to starve and feeds him only from a sense of duty. If a man dies fighting for his own freedom, it is not a sacrifice. He is not willing to live as a slave. But it is a sacrifice to the kind of man who's willing. If a man refuses to sell his convictions, it is not a sacrifice, unless he is the sort of man who has no convictions. Sacrifice could be proper only for those who have nothing to sacrifice. No values, no standards, no judgment. Those whose desires are irrational whims, blindly conceived and lightly surrendered. For a man of moral stature, whose desires are born of rational values, sacrifice is the surrender of the right to the wrong, of the good to the evil. The creed of sacrifice is a morality for the immoral, a morality that declares its own bankruptcy by confessing that it can't impart to men any personal stake in virtues or values, and that their souls are sewers of depravity which they must be taught to sacrifice. By its own confession, it is impotent to teach men to be good, and can only subject them to constant punishment. Are you thinking in some foggy stupor that it's only material values that your morality requires you to sacrifice? And what do you think are material values? Matter has no value except as a means for the satisfaction of human desires. Matter is only a tool of human values. To what service are you asked to give the material tools your virtue has produced? To the service of that which you regard as evil? To a principle you do not share? To a person you do not respect? To the achievement of a purpose opposed to your own? Else your gift is not a sacrifice. Your morality tells you to renounce the material world and to divorce your values from matter. A man whose values are given no expression in material form, whose existence is unrelated to his ideals, whose actions contradict his convictions, is a cheap little hypocrite. Yet that is the man who obeys your morality and divorces his values from matter. The man who loves one woman but sleeps with another. The man who admires the talent of a worker but hires another. The man who considers one cause to be just but donates his money to the support of another. The man who holds high standards of craftsmanship but devotes his effort to the production of trash. These are the men who have renounced matter. The men who believe that the values of their spirit cannot be brought into material reality. Do you say it is the spirit that such men have renounced? Yes, of course. You cannot have one without the other. You are an indivisible entity of matter and consciousness. Renounce your consciousness and you become a brute. Renounce your body and you become a fake. Renounce the material world and you surrender it to evil. And that is precisely the goal of your morality, the duty that your code demands of you. Give to that which you do not enjoy. Serve that which you do not admire. Submit to that which you consider evil. Surrender the world to the values of others. Deny, reject, renounce yourself. Yourself is your mind. Renounce it and you become a chunk of meat ready for any cannibal to swallow. It is your mind that they want you to surrender, all those who preach the creed of sacrifice, whatever their tags or their motives, whether they demand it for the sake of your soul or of your body, whether they promise you another life in heaven or a full stomach on this earth. Those who start by saying, "It is selfish to pursue your own wishes. You must sacrifice them to the wishes of others," end up by saying, "It is selfish to uphold your convictions. You must sacrifice them to the convictions of others." This much is true. The most selfish of all things is the independent mind that recognizes no authority higher than its own and no value higher than its judgment of truth. You are asked to sacrifice your intellectual integrity, your logic, your reason, your standard of truth, in favor of becoming a prostitute whose standard is the greatest good for the greatest number. If you search your code for guidance, for an answer to the question, "What is the good?" the only answer you will find is the good of others. The good is whatever others wish, whatever you feel they wish, or whatever you feel they ought to feel. The good of others is a magic formula that transforms anything into gold, a formula to be recited as a guarantee of moral glory, and as a fumigator for any action, even the slaughter of a continent. Your standard of virtue is not an object, not an act, not a principle, but an intention. You need no proof, no reasons, no success. You need not achieve, in fact, the good of others. All you need to know is that your motive was the good of others, not your own. Your only definition of the good is a negation. The good is the non-good for me. Your code, which boasts that it upholds eternal, absolute, objective moral values, and scorns the conditional, the relative, and the subjective. Your code hands out, as its version of the absolute, the following rule of moral conduct. If you wish it, it's evil. If others wish it, it's good. If the motive of your action is your welfare, don't do it. If the motive is the welfare of others, then anything goes. As this double-jointed, double-standard morality splits you in half, so it splits mankind into two enemy camps. One is you, the other is all the rest of humanity. You are the only outcast who has no right to wish or live. You are the only servant, the rest are the masters. You are the only giver, the rest are the takers. You are the eternal debtor, the rest are the creditors never to be paid off. You must not question their rights to your sacrifice, or the nature of their wishes and their needs. Their right is conferred upon them by a negative, by the fact that they are non-you. For those of you who might ask questions, your code provides a consolation prize and a booby trap. It is for your own happiness, it says, that you must serve the happiness of others. The only way to achieve your joy is to give it up to others. The only way to achieve your prosperity is to surrender your wealth to others. The only way to protect your life is to protect all men except yourself. And if you find no joy in this procedure, it is your own fault and the proof of your evil. If you were good, you would find your happiness in providing a banquet for others, and your dignity in existing on such crumbs as they might care to toss you. You who have no standard of self-esteem, accept the guilt and dare not ask the questions. But you know the unadmitted answer, refusing to acknowledge what you see, what hidden premise moves your world. You know it not in honest statement, but as a dark uneasiness within you, while you flounder between guiltily cheating and grudgingly practicing a principle too vicious to name. I, who do not accept the unearned, neither in values nor in guilt, am here to ask the questions you evaded. Why is it moral to serve the happiness of others but not your own? If enjoyment is a value, why is it moral when experienced by others but immoral when experienced by you? If the sensation of eating a cake is a value, why is it an immoral indulgence in your stomach, but a moral goal for you to achieve in the stomach of others? Why is it immoral for you to desire, but moral for others to do so? Why is it immoral to produce a value and keep it, but moral to give it away? And if it is not moral for you to keep a value, why is it moral for others to accept it? If you are selfless and virtuous when you give it, are they not selfish and vicious when they take it? Does virtue consist of serving vice? Is the moral purpose of those who are good self-immolation for the sake of those who are evil? The answer you evade, the monstrous answer, is no, the takers are not evil, provided they did not earn the value you gave them. It is not immoral for them to accept it, provided they are unable to produce it, unable to deserve it, unable to give you any value in return. It is not immoral for them to enjoy it, provided they do not obtain it by right. Such is the secret core of your creed, the other half of your double standard. It is immoral to live by your own effort, but moral to live by the effort of others. It is immoral to consume your own product, but moral to consume the products of others. It is immoral to earn, but moral to mooch. It is the parasites who are the moral justification for the existence of the producers. But the existence of the parasites is an end in itself. It is evil to profit by achievement, but good to profit by sacrifice. It is evil to create your own happiness, but good to enjoy it at the price of the blood of others. Your code divides mankind into two castes, and commands them to live by opposite rules. Those who may desire anything, and those who may desire nothing. The chosen and the damned. The riders and the carriers. The eaters and the eaten. What standard determines your caste? What passkey admits you to the moral elite? The passkey is lack of value. Whatever the value involved, it is your lack of it that gives you a claim upon those who don't lack it. It is your need that gives you a claim to rewards. If you are able to satisfy your need, your ability annuls your right to satisfy it. But a need you are unable to satisfy gives you the first right to the lives of mankind. If you succeed, any man who fails is your master. If you fail, any man who succeeds is your serf. Whether your failure is just or not, whether your wishes are rational or not, whether your misfortune is undeserved or the result of your vices, it is misfortune that gives you a right to rewards. It is pain, regardless of its nature or cause, pain as a primary absolute that gives you a mortgage on all of existence. If you heal your pain by your own effort, you receive no moral credit. Your code regards it scornfully as an act of self-interest. Whatever value you seek to acquire, be it wealth or food or love or rights, if you acquire it by means of your virtue, your code does not regard it as a moral acquisition. You occasion no loss to anyone. It is a trade, not alms, a payment, not a sacrifice. The deserved belongs in the selfish commercial realm of mutual profit. It is only the undeserved that calls for that moral transaction which consists of profit to one at the price of disaster to the other. To demand rewards for your virtue is selfish and immoral. It is your lack of virtue that transforms your demand into a moral right. A morality that holds need as a claim holds emptiness, non-existence, as its standard of value. It rewards an absence, a defect, weakness, inability, incompetence, suffering, disease, disaster, the lack, the fault, the flaw, the zero. Who provides the account to pay these claims? Those who are cursed for being non-zeros, each to the extent of his distance from that ideal. Since all values are the product of virtues, the degree of your virtue is used as the measure of your penalty. The degree of your faults is used as the measure of your gain. Your code declares that the rational man must sacrifice himself to the irrational, the independent man to parasites, the honest man to the dishonest, the man of justice to the unjust, the productive man to thieving loafers, the man of integrity to compromising knaves, the man of self-esteem to sniveling neurotics. Do you wonder at the meanness of souls in those you see around you? The man who achieves these virtues will not accept your moral code. The man who accepts your moral code will not achieve these virtues. Under a morality of sacrifice, the first value you sacrifice is morality. The next is self-esteem. When need is the standard, every man is both victim and parasite. As a victim, he must labor to fill the needs of others, leaving himself in the position of a parasite whose needs must be filled by others. He cannot approach his fellow man except in one of two disgraceful roles. He is both a beggar and a sucker. You fear the man who has a dollar less than you. That dollar is rightfully his. He makes you feel like a moral defrauder. You hate the man who has a dollar more than you. That dollar is rightfully yours. He makes you feel that you are morally defrauded. The man below is a source of your guilt. The man above is a source of your frustration. You do not know what to surrender or demand, when to give and when to grab, what pleasure in life is rightfully yours and what debt is still unpaid to others. You struggle to evade, as theory, the knowledge that by the moral standard you've accepted, you are guilty every moment of your life. There is no mouthful of food you swallow that is not needed by someone somewhere on earth, and you give up the problem in blind resentment. You conclude that moral perfection is not to be achieved or desired, that you will muddle through by snatching as snatch can and by avoiding the eyes of the young, of those who look at you as if self-esteem were possible, and they expected you to have it. Guilt is all that you retain within your soul, and so does every other man as he goes past, avoiding your eyes. Do you wonder why your morality has not achieved brotherhood on earth, or the goodwill of man to man? The justification of sacrifice that your morality propounds is more corrupt than the corruption it purports to justify. The motive of your sacrifice, it tells you, should be love. The love you ought to feel for every man. A morality that professes the belief that the values of the spirit are more precious than matter. A morality that teaches you to scorn a whore who gives her body indiscriminately to all men. This same morality demands that you surrender your soul to promiscuous love for all comers. As there can be no causeless wealth, so there can be no causeless love, or any sort of causeless emotion. An emotion is a response to a fact of reality, an estimate dictated by your standards. To love is to value. The man who tells you that it is possible to value without values, to love those whom you appraise as worthless, is the man who tells you that it is possible to grow rich by consuming without producing, and that paper money is as valuable as gold. Observe that he does not expect you to feel a causeless fear. When his kind get into power, they are expert at contriving means of terror, at giving you ample cause to feel the fear by which they desire to rule you. But when it comes to love, the highest of emotions, you permit them to shriek at you accusingly that you are a moral delinquent if you're incapable of feeling causeless love. When a man feels fear without reason, you call him to the attention of a psychiatrist. You are not so careful to protect the meaning, the nature, and the dignity of love. Love is the expression of one's values, the greatest reward you can earn for the moral qualities you have achieved in your character and person, the emotional price paid by one man for the joy he receives from the virtues of another. Your morality demands that you divorce your love from values and hand it down to any vagrant, not as response to his worth, but as response to his need, not as reward, but as alms, not as a payment for virtues, but as a blank check on vices. Your morality tells you that the purpose of love is to set you free of the bonds of morality, that love is superior to moral judgment, that true love transcends, forgives, and survives every manner of evil in its object, and that the greater the love, the greater the depravity it permits to the loved. To love a man for his virtues is paltry and human, it tells you. To love him for his flaws is divine. To love those who are worthy of it is self-interest. To love the unworthy is sacrifice. This book is continued on Disc 6.